everyone in the audience was Japanese tourists, and none of them understood any English.
Welcome, and this is Far Betterment. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Far Betterment, the podcast where we learn new things about old friends and old things about new friends. In this episode, I'm joined by Colorado sports journalist Derek Kessinger. Derek is an excellent writer, has a great outlook on life, very positive, very introspective, and I'm really honored that he joined me today on Far Betterment. Also, as a bonus for all of you Colorado Avalanche fans out there, we did talk about the Colorado Avalanche, so be sure to listen through to the end to hear some of that bonus material. So without further ado, here's Derek Kessinger for Far Betterment. So how long have you been doing that, you know, working? And I'm not really sure your capacity with the team. I guess we've never really talked about it. I mean, I know you've written for things like that. But I remember at one point you kind of left and then went to Chicago or New York, I'm sorry, and then went to Chicago after that, right?
Yes. So I left and I did this program. It was called the Experience Institute. And I was in New York for the fall, Chicago for the spring, and Seattle for the summer that year.
Okay. Wow. That's a busy year.
Yeah. So with the times I was in Denver, I was in every time zone, which was a weird experience. It was so out of college, I got the play-by-play job with the Denver Cutthroats and did that for a year before the team folded. And then have written for multiple people in different capacities, 5280 magazine, and I interned there and then did some freelance stuff for them, and then Mile High Sports. And I worked in this job for this company, and I have no idea what its name is. They changed it all the time, but I would get radio clips from the locker rooms. So like six clips of each team, or three clips of each team for the game. So that's how I got a lot of my coverage for Avs, Nuggets, and Rockies. And then I actually interned at KOA in college. Okay. Did some Broncos there too. So that's sort of how I built up my Denver sports resume through the years.
And I've seen you do some Rockies stuff too. Is that right?
Yeah. So the other thing that I was doing back in high school and college and then sort of came back to when I came back from Experience Institute was I worked in concessions for a novelty concessions company that does like lemonade and cotton candy and Dippin' Dots, like all of the fun stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I did that for the last 2 years, when I came back, as a supervisor and then helped run Coors Field's, their concessions, and also have done Broncos stuff and still do a little Broncos stuff. I mean, that was sort of just from Experience Institute. I went there and my goal was to really focus on alternative ways to tell stories and look at like new and interesting technology that was coming up. And actually podcasts were just taking off then. I think Serial had happened, I think a year before I went into this program, and there was this company called Gimlet that I really wanted to work for and tried a couple of times when I was in this program to get one of my experiences there. And I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have through your, newsletter, which okay. I think we should definitely talk about here in a little bit. Cause I loved your newsletter. I actually really, really enjoyed reading that when you used to send it out.
Yeah, but, well, thank you. So
they
started with a show called Startup, which is their most famous show.
Okay.
And basically all podcasts came out of This American Life. Like the guy that started Gimlet was from This American Life, and he got other people. So they have that. And then their second show was Reply All, which I also really loved. To this day, I think that it is probably the one like piece of media that I just think is like good to have in the world. And if you're having a bad day, it's like the best show to listen to. And it was tagged as a show about the internet, but it's become much more since then. So I wanted to work for them. And now they actually just sold to Spotify for like $300 million.
Wow.
So that was the transition sort of from where I was then to now in the industry, especially in podcasts, which is just crazy to think about. So that was sort of my goal going into Experiences 2. And then once I was done, I was like, I hadn't really gotten the experiences I was looking for with companies. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of looking at what should I do next? And the lemonade company was like, we need some help. So I went back there for a while, and luckily I'm not doing that anymore.
So that wasn't something you were like too excited about, but what'd you do? Like when you went into the Experiences Institute, I know your goal was to, you know, like learn as much as you possibly can. What do you think the most valuable experience that you took from that?
Yeah. So I think the thing that I'm still sort of learning, but this was where I really learned it, was just how a lot of people look like they're doing, like people on the outside look like they're doing great, mm-hmm. but then you get inside and you like see all of those problems. And that was especially true with my year, where I was going into companies and, you know, the goals weren't aligned with, their goals inside weren't aligned with what they were saying they were doing. And that is very valuable, especially when you talk about things like imposter syndrome. When you see people that outwardly look very successful and on the inside, you're like, oh, they don't actually know what they're doing. Which was the case, really more outside of Experiences Institute than inside. It's very interesting to see that develop. In New York, I went to this company that no longer exists, but they were trying to do an app that would be like a virtual tour of New York through stories.
Okay.
Which was a really cool idea. So for example, there's this building in Times Square, that is actually, where Carole King started her career. They were a music studio, and you'd never notice it. And so it would be like stories like that, where it would just like, you'd be walking through New York City and it would be like, this story happened here, or this art is this way, because of this. And so I was really interested in that idea. But the infrastructure just wasn't there to support that idea.
That's too bad, 'cause that is a really cool idea. Actually, like that is a cool idea.
Yeah. And just like thinking about like, when you're in a new city, just like you can walk through it and you can discover all these things, but you can't really get that historical richness.
Yeah.
And especially in New York, like one of my biggest takeaways in New York was you would walk down a street. It'd be like, this street is so familiar and I don't know why, but I know that I've seen it in a movie or a TV show. And the whole city is like that. It's like, there's the layer of how New York is now. And then there's the layer of all the culture in New York that is sort of like hovering above everything. And that's just a very fascinating thing to experience.
What do you think your favorite, you know, place was to live over that year?
Yeah. So if you have infinite amounts of money, New York is definitely where you should live. Like, okay. I understand why people live there, but it is very hard if you don't just have infinite resources, because you know, you have to go walk down the street to the grocery store, and like the Trader Joe's there has a line that's all the way through the store on weekends. Oh, so like grocery shopping is hard, and like no one has laundry in buildings. So you got to walk down the street to the laundromat, and you know, transportation is always a hard thing to navigate. So that, I think that was sort of why I really like New York, and it's a great place to visit. And if you could do it right, it would be great, but it's hard.
Yeah.
Chicago, enjoyed. I was there in the spring, and they have like, you know, the freezing rainstorms, and so I got like kind of not the coldest, but not the most fun weather. And I think that's sort of the thing about Chicago, is it's like got all these great things, but the weather is kind of not great a lot of the time. And then I really loved Seattle in the summer, because I was there and it was like 73 degrees and sunny every day. It would rain a little bit, but it wouldn't be too bad. And it reminded me, the pace was a lot like Denver, and probably even more Boulder, which is where I went to college. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. It was just the pace was a lot slower, and that fits me a lot better, I think, and is one of the reasons that even though Denver is still growing so much, I really like it here, because people care about things outside of just like getting from one place to the next, but really enjoying, you know, nature and the weather and being outside.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite an appeal to living in Denver. It's been a while since I've been back, but I definitely miss, you know, miss some aspects of it, and makes me nostalgic just thinking about it. So
I mean, the lack of humidity, that's the main thing you get here. That is like the secret key of Denver.
That's true. That's very true. And there's an advantage to growing up at altitude. I mean, there just is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you have that, and then it's like you have like these superhuman lungs, and you know, when you go other places, your drinking tolerance goes up, and you're
just
like,
big time.
Yeah, so it's definitely growing up here. You definitely get a few, at least temporary superpowers. It feels like when you go back down to sea level.
Yeah, I've lost all those now, but I used to have them. They're all gone.
Yeah,
now.
I'm sure. Even a brief visit, it would all come back.
I hope so. We'll see. I'll be out there in May, so we'll see. So I don't know if this is kind of too broad of a question, but and I think you touched on it a little bit, but what did you learn about yourself specifically? I know a lot of your writing is really introspective, and that's kind of what I like about it a lot, is that you're always looking at yourself in ways you can improve, in ways you can improve those around you and the world. So what do you think you've learned about yourself specifically over the course of just your career in general?
Yeah, I think it's probably several things, but I think one thing that I've really, really been working on and working towards is understanding sort of how to be compassionate with myself in that space. So as you said, like a lot of like my writing and work is very introspective and connecting things. But that's a lot of thinking. Like it comes from a lot of the thinking place. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that doesn't have, you know, the empathy and compassion that I would like to have for myself. And I think that when I do that in my writing and in my work, that's when things are the best. And I think that some of those pieces that I was doing during that year, you could really feel that in the work that I was doing. And then there were other periods where I felt like I wasn't doing that as well. So trying to just connect to being human, which sounds kind of corny, but it's
not something
that I feel like as our culture, we almost try to edit out. And I was talking to a friend about this, where there was someone that we knew that was working on like, you know, augmented intelligence, where you could like have higher brain power. And I was just thinking about how like a lot of times it feels like we're trying to make up for our human flaws in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I like a lot about storytelling in general, is that like the best stories put our very human flaws on display. And, you know, when that happens, it's how do we deal with that situation? And oftentimes like the stories we love the most are the ones where the flaws turn into strengths, or we're able to overcome our flaws because of lessons we learned along the way.
Where did that idea, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Yeah, no, it does. Absolutely. I mean, you've always been really great at looking at yourself. And like I said, that's one of the things I really, really liked. But where did that idea come from for the newsletter itself?
Yeah, so I think, so the newsletter, for anyone listening that doesn't know, it was based on storytelling specifically, and it sort of evolved into different things. But I think that I've always been fascinated with how stories affect our lives in different ways. And there's this idea, it's called, it's a study of psychology called narrative psychology, that really focuses on how our brain creates meaning out of stories, and how your brain making the wrong connection to something can completely change the story of how you see something, in a good way or a bad way. And so that was sort of what really got me interested in studying storytelling in that year, was how do you make stories, and how do you find stories that really do that, where it actually adds something to the story just by having listened to it, whether it's through metaphor or just that vulnerability and that honesty, which I always really enjoy. So I think it was somewhere in that. And some of that was actually from my work in sports. There's this game that, and especially covering the Rockies during the bad years, that you would see where, you know, they lose like 8-2 and you'd have to go into the locker room and get interviews. And it was like, everyone knew that it was a game and it wasn't their fault because the team was just bad, but everyone had to act really serious because if they didn't, someone would be mad that they weren't taking it seriously enough. And that's sort of how all of the sports coverage works. It's all fake on a level that everyone's trying to project something. And a lot of honesty doesn't come through that way. I'm sure like you've seen this on sports, on social media with sports too, where people have these very strong takes and they argue. And at the end of the day, there's not that much difference between one or the other, but yeah, they build it up that way.
Oh yeah.
And so that was sort of where that came from, where I was just tired of not being able to have fun with sports, which is what it sort of became, at least for me and the way that I was looking at it at the time. I didn't see how do you make this fun. And it didn't seem like if you can't have fun covering sports, or if just sports in general can't be fun, like really nothing's going to be that fun.
So do you think you've regained that passion and that fun in the last, you know, year or two?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely trying to and still experimenting with it. When I was writing the columns for Mile High Sports, I really focused on like what is interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And that allowed for some experimentation. There was this one article that I wrote that several people really didn't like, which was surprising because usually I don't get any feedback. So I was like, oh, this is really weird. But it was about the week before NBA free agency, and it was just about like the future if LeBron actually chose the Nuggets, even though I knew he wasn't going to choose the Nuggets. Mm-hmm. And it's like those thought exercises I think are really interesting, and getting away from the hot take, like putting one opinion against another, is really interesting to me. And so that's sort of how I've tried to approach sports, and just really, I don't miss the reporting aspect of sports for that reason. There are really great reporters in Denver that do really good work. And I had a hard time balancing that, the honesty with the players that you need, where you're sort of playing that game with them. And it was like, you know, they all very, for very good reasons, are very protective because, you know, if they say the wrong thing, it's going to be the number one story in the town for the next day.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to lose by being honest, in sports right now. And so I've tried to recapture some of the fun that I had definitely with sports, growing up.
How'd you get into that? Or not specifically how'd you get into it, but like, where was the passion from, you know, for writing and then combining that with sports? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I was always like a sports fan, like from a young age. Both of my parents come from big sports traditions, and I was a huge Rockies fan at like 3 years old. But then when the Avs came to town, you know, I was five that first year, and I was just taken away by it. I mean, I'd never really seen hockey before then. And obviously like, it's not like a lot was going on. Like, I don't have a lot of like formative memories before this time, but just how fast it was and how good those teams were those early years. It was all I really wanted to spend my time doing and thinking about was how are the Avs doing? And then that sort of built up, you know, cause the Broncos won the next couple of years. And then later on when the Rockies were always like the team that I loved, but never, it was just like, it was fun to go to games, but they were never going to win anything. So what did it matter, until 2007? So I think it was just like, I really love the not knowing what's going to happen in sports. Like, that's what makes sports great. And you really can't get that in other things in life, where the stakes are so low. Mm. You know, like we can be like, we have no idea what's going to happen in politics, but the stakes feel pretty high a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so I really like the aspect of sports where you don't know what's going to happen, but the consequences are pretty small, other than like you're going to be heartbroken and sad. And so it's like a testing ground for, does this work? Does that work? Do these players work together? And you can, I think you can get a lot out of that to use in life too, in other aspects. And it's like the ultimate lab, because we get to see these results in real time.
Now, I know you were talking about storytelling, and you've brought that up several times. And you mentioned to me in private that, you know, you wanted to use storytelling to make a positive impact. How do you see that forming or coming to fruition?
I think it's still the question that I'm trying to solve. But I think the thing for me, I was listening to something that Malcolm Gladwell was talking about, where he was just talking about how, you know, seeing curious people and following your curiosities and turning that into stories really can have an impact on people, whether it's just changing people's states or allowing them to look at something differently. And so I really see it from that aspect. And for me, it's, how do you make this entertaining? That's always the top thing. Like, boring stories no one cares about or wants to listen to. But then how do you really make a connection with the audience you're trying to connect with? And how do you take something that already exists and elevate it in some way? Which was something I really was thinking a lot about that year, is that elevation piece. And I think that is everything from taking like what the work that Malcolm Gladwell does, where he'll take, you know, a scientific study and he'll put a human face into it. Like, I think that elevates the work. Or a story we've heard 100 times with a new twist, or a metaphor for something going on in people's lives. I think it's all in there, and it can take a lot of different forms. But I think for me, the thing that still matters the most in that is that we put the stories at the center of that. So it's not like we're doing this so then we can sell more shoes. It's like we're doing this because we want to help people realize something about themselves or the world, and then apply that so that they can better do whatever they're trying to do.
So it sounds like you're always kind of experimenting with your writing and different styles and different ways to tell a story. Is that right? That kind of,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's sort of, and I think the thing that, especially during that year, and it's still sort of the thing that I wrestle with, is the medium doesn't matter as much for me. Like, okay, I don't want to just like write books if like the story I want to tell isn't good for books, or, you know, I think some stories do better, audio, you know, is an audio version. Like this conversation, I think, when you're really trying to connect with someone, audio is great for that. And video has places where it does amazing things. And so that's something that I've always been cognizant of, is that the stories and the way that you tell them, it's like you have to find the right place for it. And I think that that's through the first process, through the editing process. And I think that's sort of where it comes back to our lives and the way that we edit the stories of our lives, where we throw, you know, so many details out, and then we're like, these were the defining experiences, or these were the things that really impacted me on that situation. And so I think it all comes back to sort of how we tell those stories.
I really like that, especially what you said about connection. And I think a lot of writers kind of pigeonhole themselves into, you know, I'm a writer and that's it. That's how I'm going to tell my story. This is how I tell my story. This is my voice. And I think that's great. You know, this is my voice. This is how I want to talk to you. But I really like that you've taken it to a whole nother level. And, cause I know you've started your own podcast. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Cause I think that's, really interesting as well, especially on a podcast, to talk about your podcast.
Yeah. So, right now I've started several podcasts. I'm not going to lie. And I'm sure that a lot of people who try to start a podcast, you know, go back and forth. But the one I'm working on right now, is with my friend Quinn, and he's someone I knew in high school, but we weren't friends in high school. And we've sort of transitioned, because we both love sports, and we actually went to an arts high school. he went for acting and I went for singing. And there are only like 5 sports fans in the whole high school. So you know each other, and then that, you know, bond is connected. And so we've really been experimenting with how to tell sports stories in different ways, because it seems like everyone's doing the same thing. And we haven't found the tone we're looking for quite yet, but we are trying to keep those ideas of like, the goal of this is to create connection with the audience. We want to be as inclusive as possible, because we feel like anyone can be a sports fan, and we want to share, maybe this is a bad thing because we both know how painful sports could be, but we want to share sports with people because we feel like it can really, you know, have a positive impact on their lives. And then, you know, then you have the heartbreaking losses and you're like, why did we do this again? Like, why did we want to bring our friends into this?
Yeah.
but it has been interesting to really think about what's out there, especially in Denver, which is in some ways a oversaturated market for sports, but it's an always evolving market for sports. And everyone's always competing against the Broncos coverage. And so it's been interesting. I'm still not exactly sure where we're going to go with it, but I'm sure as you have with this podcast, it's really interesting to like listen to it and be like, this isn't quite what I want yet, but try to figure out what it is that I'm looking for.
Oh yeah. I definitely have that feeling where I'm still trying to figure it out. And I'm 26 episodes in, 25 episodes in, and I'm still trying to figure out, you know, this episode's better than this one. This conversation went better. What do I like from here? So I completely get that.
My like weird rule for podcasts that people are creating is that like the show becomes what it is around episode 100. And so if that's sort of the thing that you realize that like everything up to 100, like you're just trying to figure it out. And then like after that, it's probably figured out what it is. You've tried everything you're going to try. And so like right now you're just like a quarter of the way through the testing phase.
I like that.
To sort of see what that is.
That makes me feel much better. Yeah, I like that. You know, I kind of hadn't really considered it at all. I just was hoping that someday I'd get it, that I'd figure it out. And, you know,
go ahead and then I'll say what I was going to.
I was just going to say, I think my thing is I just really like talking to people and learning their story and hearing, you know, what's important to them and their structure, you know, their bones, their soul, like what it is about them that makes them tick and be passionate about. So that's why I think I really wanted to interview you, because I think you're a person that comes across as very passionate about what you do. And you don't hide that, and you've been vulnerable, and I like that. And you're very honest. And that's genuine, I think. That's the best word for why I wanted to speak with you. You're a genuine kind of person. So, and I wanted...
Appreciate that.
No, I mean that,
and
too.
I just wanted to add that sort of like in all of this and sort of like I'm definitely in a time of transition, like trying to figure out like what it is I want to be doing and what's next. But like that honesty is like the hardest thing. And I'm sure you probably have encountered this even with the podcast. Like it is hard and vulnerable to put yourself out there and try to make new things. And so I appreciate that you're doing this podcast and that you've stuck with it, because I think that and this is the other thing that I was actually going to say, is you don't know exactly who it is you're going to help until it's sort of been made and been out there for a while, and who those conversations are for. And I think, and this is something I learned a lot when I was doing the journalism, is that oftentimes the people that you're helping are the people that you're interviewing or the people that you're having those conversations with, because they get to tell their story. And so I think that that's really great.
Well, I appreciate that, especially coming from you. You know, especially somebody who connecting with people is so important to you. And I was actually, that brings up a question I was going to ask you is, you know, how have you found that you've connected with people? How have you found that you've found common ground with others?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one thing that I always try to do is understand where the other person is coming from first. This is something that especially comes in from the sports world, where you know, someone says something really stupid and you're like, you really just want to attack them and be like, and this is true with hockey fans especially, and I'm sure you know this, like where someone comes in and they make some ignorant comment and you're like, oh, we just need to destroy this person.
Oh yeah.
And if you think about it for a second and you're like, where are they coming from? Like, how much knowledge do they have? Like, is this a reasonable thing to think if you don't know that much about hockey, and how can we bring them along? That's always a good starting point for me, is knowing who you're performing for in some way when you're doing your work. There's this story, and I can't remember what comedian it was, but he was doing really well and he went to this gig and no one laughed at a single joke. And he was like, oh man, I'm devastated. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And afterwards he finds out that everyone in the audience was Japanese tourists and none of them understood any English. And so it wasn't that his material was bad. It was just that the audience was the worst audience he could have. And I like to think about that, like finding that connection is so important. And you can really only do that if you know where the other people are coming from, and sort of what they're looking for. So I try to do that. And I think that, like with the sports stuff, it's finding the people that I feel like are sort of at the same place that I am, which is like my friend Quinn, where we're like, we want to talk about sports. We want to have fun doing it. And we don't want to make it this serious thing or this competition. And so that is sort of the audience we're looking for. And we realize that that's smaller than like every sports fan. And it's why we don't, like, we did a podcast yesterday and we didn't talk about the NFL draft at all, which is what everyone else in Denver is talking about.
Sure.
Because we're like, we can't say anything interesting. We don't want to fight about like who the next Broncos quarterback is going to be, because that's all that anyone's talked about for 3 years. So we have decided that those people aren't our audience. And so it's just like trying to connect with the people who we feel like do match up on our values in that way.
And that's interesting, because that's really hard to do in sports, I think, especially because, like you were saying, people are really passionate and they have an opinion and they're willing to fight for that opinion to the end, no matter what. And I don't know if you know this, but, and I think we've spoken about this before, because early on I was trying to get into writing and sports writing and stuff specifically, and had actually applied and spoken with Cheryl Bradley at Mile High.
Oh, yeah.
For me, it was really hard to get over like the negative comments. If you would get negative comments, like it was tough. I didn't have the thick skin. Like, how have you dealt with that? And negative comments and all of it, really.
So I definitely, and it was worse. I think my confidence definitely went down around this, but it is hard to get around that. And the thing that I don't know if you know who Seth Godin is, but he's this marketing guy. And okay. He says that negative feedback, the way that you respond to negative feedback is, thank you, this isn't for you. And that, like, if you can keep that mindset, it just makes so much difference, because mm-hmm. you can be like, that person hated it, but clearly this was not for them. This was not the connection that they wanted to make there. And so that, and I mean, Mile High Hockey, that was not a place where it was like, the community was there to fight.
Oh yeah.
Like, that was what they loved doing. So the negativity was built into the model. Like, I don't know how it is now. I haven't been there in years, but I remember, and I was afraid to post on there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I never posted on Mile High Hockey because I was afraid of the hockey people, especially because I care about all four sports in Denver, mm-hmm. which is not like, that's definitely in the minority. People usually have a sport that they care about and then the other ones. And hockey is definitely my favorite sport, but I can't know everything about hockey if I also know what's going on with the four other teams in town. Mm-hmm. And so that was always my fear around hockey, especially. And I'd say that the worst criticism I got was always about hockey. And that, like, definitely got me to not want to write about it as much or talk about it as much, because I know there are a lot of people out there who know a lot more about hockey than I do. And so I have to be like, I bring a different perspective to this. And that's sort of what I've been trying to do, sort of with all of this, is just, I bring this perspective. It's not going to be for everyone. And I think that the other piece of this, and sort of, this was sort of the reason that I sort of stopped doing the newsletter that we talked about and sort of haven't published as much, as there's definitely this moment in our society where people have very strong opinions and a lot of them are valid. And it feels like whenever you're adding to the noise, you don't want to hurt anyone's feelings or invalidate anyone's feelings. And so that is always in the back of my mind. And I've definitely had to sit back and think, like, if I'm doing this with good intentions, that has to be enough. Like, if, as long as I'm like aware enough of what those things could be, and I feel like I've addressed them to the point of my ability, and I'm not trying to be intentionally insensitive, like, mm-hmm. that's as good as I can do. And a lot of the strongest voices, my work is never going to be for them, because I'm never going to be declarative enough. And I'm okay with that, I think, at this point. But it's taken the last couple of years to sort of get back to that point.
So a couple of years ago, I mean, was there a point where you were just like, I can't, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. This is getting to be too much. Where you kind of almost gave it up?
I think it was never like I sort of stopped publishing. I didn't mm-hmm. stop writing as much, but I was definitely at this place where I was just like, I don't know what to say next. Like, I don't know. I'm at a place where I feel so lost in what's going on in our, you know, in our society and sort of in our life, that I don't know what to say next in a compassionate way. And so I sort of just stopped, and it wasn't intentional. It was just like, I found myself not knowing how to like publish it. It still is a struggle. And I think it's a struggle for anyone that creates anything. But I definitely, like, after Experience Institute, and, you know, I'd done that newsletter, and I'd had, you know, a good group of people following that. And then for me to come out and say, well, things didn't work out how I wanted them to, and now I'm back in Lemonade. Like, that seemed like a very hard conversation to have. And so I think that was the moment where I was like, I just stopped, because I no longer liked the story that I was telling. And it sort of gets back to that, like, you know, what in actuality was happening was, I took an opportunity that I thought, you know, this is what I can do right now. And that is still a very good story, but that wasn't the story I was telling at the time, at least to myself.
So as a writer, what does, you know, success versus failure look like for you? Learning what you've learned through the course of the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I think one of the things, and you sort of touched on this, is finding, you know, I want things to sound like me, even if it's a different medium and a different thing, like, you know, whether it's like the sort of sarcastic me or whether it's the very compassionate me, I want to make sure that I'm at the center of what I'm doing, because I like the artists best who are at the center of what they're doing. I don't know if you know who Neil Gaiman is, but he's a writer that... Sorry, what'd you say?
I said, I don't know. Sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine. But he's a writer that I really like. He does fantasy. Some of his biggest things are American Gods, which they've made into a TV show, and Coraline is actually his book that they made into a movie.
Okay.
And Angels and Demons, which is going to be on Amazon here coming up. But his books are very, like, you can tell the tone. And he actually started in comic books and then moved over to novels. But he has this book that's, I would highly recommend the audio full cast version of it if you have an Audible subscription. It's called The Graveyard Book. And his premise for it was, it was the Jungle Book, but instead of the boy being raised in a jungle, he was raised in a graveyard.
And that's interesting.
And it's just a wonderful book and has really great characters. And it's sort of for children, but like, it's just like, it's so wonderful. But he got this idea probably when he was in his 20s. And he started writing, and he was like, I'm not good enough to write this book. And he put it away for 20 years and then ended up writing it. And then, you know, it won all these awards, and they made all these audio versions of it. And like, it's really great. But he recently found the first version of it, and he went through it, and he's like, oh, like, I was right. Like, I didn't have it. But he was like, there were 3 or 4 pages in there that sounded like me. And that was really rewarding to know that I was there in those pages at some point. And so that's one of the things that I really think is success. If I can feel like I am there, and not in a selfish way, but just because, like, I can only write as myself, at least in an effective way. I can pretend to write as other people, but I don't think that it will make the connection, that writing as myself or presenting myself, vulnerably will, to others.
That's what you're saying. Okay. So what, is there a thing where you felt that you failed at that you learned from?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, in a lot of ways, like a lot more lessons in failure than in success, mm-hmm. At least where I am right now. And I think that like is as I've been trying to do, and I feel like I've been good. It's not a failure as long as you learn something. And I feel like I have learned a lot with the failures. I think one of them is in a lot of this that we're talking about is that, you know, the things that you create aren't going to be for everyone, and you have to be okay with that. And the times where I haven't put myself fully out there because I've been worried about that, I feel like have been failures, because I feel like if my best work had been out there, the outcome may have been different, and I didn't give my full self to that. So that's definitely something that I feel like I've learned. Something else is just going back to that idea that everyone doesn't know that what they're doing all of the time, is figuring out how to always be listening and at least knowing where people are coming from, both in the work that you're doing, in the situation you are in, or just like in life. If you can find the distance to step away and say like, what's going on in this person's head, I think that can make a huge difference and sort of help you see like three steps ahead of where this is going. Whether it was like, you know, jobs that I had where I was like, oh, like if I'd actually been like where I am now, I could have seen like where this was going to go off the rails. And so I'm trying to be more mindful of how other people are seeing things, and then I can sort of change what I'm doing to sort of play to the strengths of that without changing the message of what I'm doing.
I think that's actually like really valuable advice, and I think everybody should try to do that. Put yourself in someone else's shoes and understand where they're coming from. And
it's one of those things where I'm very good at giving advice to other people, mm-hmm. and then I don't take the advice, and it's just like, it's because I can't get that distance. You can get the distance when it's somebody else, but when it's yourself, you're like, oh no, like this isn't the same problem. Like, look at all these other problems. But when it's, you know, someone else, it's very easy to get that distance.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I agree with that. But I think part of that is just that when it's you in that situation, you think a lot more about the variables of how, you know, this will affect you or the consequences, and you really get into your own head a lot more, where, you know, when it's someone else, you can almost see further the outcome for them or the good outcome that you want. So that makes perfect
sense. And I think that in that, just like trying to be accommodating and warm to everyone, that was something that at the Lemonade Company was a big deal. Like, you know, the days there are 12 to 14 hour days. You're working, especially Rockies, you know, you're working 7 days in a row or more, or, you know, you work 10 out of 12 or something. And so everyone's exhausted. Everyone has their own things going on at home, especially, you know, a lot of the people working there had minimum wage jobs, and that's never a good lifestyle, especially if you're, you know, not young. And so like bringing that compassion and understanding that like these people have all of these things going on in their lives too. And if you can at least be one of the better parts of their day, then you've been successful in some way. And I sort of translate that to the work that I'm doing, especially when you like have to like speak in front of a group, like mm-hmm. understanding what the conditions are that they are in, what is the best way where I can reach them in this way. And it may not be the way that's best for me in some of those instances.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And that kind of just kind of dovetailing, or well, not really dovetailing, but going completely off track. what would you say, I guess, not really the differences, but positives versus negatives as writing as a job versus mm-hmm. as a passion?
Yeah, I think writing as a job just isn't that great. I'm not going to lie.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. I like the honesty.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I think I saw something that it was like the average freelance writer makes $26,000 a year. And if you throw in everyone that writes a little bit, like anyone that tries to write for money, the average goes down to $7,000 a year.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's that big of a drop off if you just include everyone. And I think that a lot of that is that writing generically has gotten so cheap. You can find anyone that'll write 100-word article that you put on your website that's only going to get a few clicks. And so there isn't, you know, especially with the way that the internet doesn't make any money right now. Writing for the internet is not a lucrative career. And so it's definitely one where you have to think about how can you support it in other ways. And a lot of people that I know that do that well, you know, it's speaking or it's teaching or it's, you know, having a second job and then transitioning it into the passion thing. And I think the thing about writing about your passions is that can turn into a job, because people are going to see that and they're going to be like, oh, like this is what we need. And those are the people you're actually trying to reach. And so that's sort of been for me sort of, again, like sort of transitioning and trying to figure out what that is. Like no matter what I do going forward, I want to make sure that there's a space where I can write the things that I'm passionate about, because otherwise I don't think I can distinguish myself as a writer or a storyteller. And I don't think that there isn't a huge need for writers right now. Just in general, there are enough writers. There isn't enough really good content out there.
I agree with that. The content is very generic right now, whether it's sports or, I mean, anything really right now. What is your... So, speaking about writing as a job and as a hobby, or as a passion, rather, what's your process like then? You know, is it different from job to passion, or is it the same process throughout?
Yeah, I mean, when it's a job, the good and the bad thing about it is that there's a deadline, and you have to meet that deadline. And so at that point, it's either good or bad. Like that's as good as you can do, or that's as bad as you can do. And when it's a passion, there aren't real deadlines. Like you can say, like, I'm going to do this at this time, or you can try to get people to make a deadline for you. But you could edit forever. Like you can work on something for years. And, you know, there are horror stories about people that worked on a novel for 20 years and then it failed. And so you have to like get out of that, that headspace really when you're doing that. And so my writing process has evolved a lot, but the thing that I've been trying to do a lot more is write, freehand. So get a notebook and just write. And then the editing process is when you put it on the computer. When I'm doing a job, for the most part, I always just write it on the computer because I'm like, that'll save a lot of time. But time is sort of the luxury, but also the curse when you're doing it just as a passion.
So do you think that you're allowed to display your values more then? I mean, obviously as a passion, but do you still try to instill that into your job as a writer?
Yeah, I think that was one of the reasons that I was really looking to do something else at the time, was I was completely, whoever I was working for, I was trying to sort of fulfill things at their level of value.
Okay.
And so it's something that if I could go back and do it again, I'd be like, no, you need to like be yourself, and find the places for that. And some of the places I worked that wouldn't have worked. Like they have a tone and you are a writer for them. But some of them, I think my work would have been valued a little bit more. And so I think in both ways, like, I just think if you're going to do something that you're passionate about and try to make that into a job, you can't lose the passion, or else it's just at that point, go do a different job because it'll probably pay more and it'll be less stressful.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And you can be passionate.
Yeah. I guess that's a hard thing to reconcile, is do you want to be passionate every day and try to do something that you love and make nothing, in a lot of cases, or do you want to not have to worry so much about outside stresses, I guess, and make some money? And I don't know. I'm in the first camp, I think. I'd rather struggle for my passion, I guess. And maybe that's stupid, but
no, I don't think it is. I think it's just, can you keep that passion when you're doing it? And I think that's what I've had such a hard time with. Elizabeth Gilbert has this thing that she talks about where she's like, you have to have a job. So you have a job and then you can have a craft, and the craft is your passion. Yeah. And if you can make both of those things work at the same time, that's great. But if you can't, then just treat your job like a job and don't worry so much about that. And then really, you know, focus your passionate energy on your craft.
I think that's also great advice. It's
great advice. Easier said than done, but
of course, yeah. Unfortunately, in this day and age, it is. So is there something, you know, that maybe you would have told yourself, or something that you've learned that you'd tell your future self if you could, something that you wish you would have known?
Yeah.
I know that's kind of a generic question, but
No.
It's interesting.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good question. I think the main thing I would say is that it doesn't have to, like, all of this doesn't have to be serious. Like, you should enjoy the times of your life that you're in as much as you can, because there will be new opportunities and there will be new challenges, and you don't know what those will be. And so worrying about that in the moment, if you just spend the time while you have it working on the things in front of you, I think it just leads to a happier life.
Is there something you think you missed out on during the course of that, you know, from college even to now?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some of it is, I graduated from CU with a journalism degree, and one of my classmates is going to be the speaker for the entire CU graduation. And to put that in perspective, Julie Andrews was the speaker at my college graduation. So like, it's like, this person is at the same level as Julie Andrews since college. And she works at the Today Show. Like, I actually really like her. But it's like, you know, when you're comparing yourself to people like that the whole time, it's like, you feel like a failure, because no one's asking you to speak at, or me, maybe people are asking you to speak at their college.
No, definitely
graduation.
Not.
And so I think that I was so worried about that. Like, where is this leading? What are the next steps? How can I gain that prestigiousness? That I do feel like I missed out on, just like some of the fun of it, of, you know, like, I got to work at some cool places and be in cool environments and interview, you know, Hall of Famers and all of that. And I think if I had been less worried about where is this taking me, I would have been able to enjoy that more at the time.
Do you think you worked harder now to not be like that? Or does that still creep in a little bit once in a while?
Well, when I found out that she was speaking at the graduation, it definitely creeped in. Mm-hmm. But I think it is getting better. And I think some of it is definitely the age. And I mean, I'm still in my 20s, so it's, you know, that's still there. And it's hard to say, like, I'm so much older and wiser now. But I do think when you get out of college, you don't have a roadmap anymore. Like, or if you don't go to college, it ends at high school. But up until that point, basically people are telling you what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And then you get to this place where no one's telling you what to do, and there's no scoreboard anymore. Like, what is success? And you have to figure that out for yourself. And I think that is very scary. And I think it makes you take a lot of bad advice too, because you're like, well, these people probably know what they're doing because they're in this position of power. And so I think that's sort of what I feel like I missed out on, is I lost some of that confidence that I had when I knew what the rules were. And so it's sort of, now that I feel like I at least sort of know what the rules are again, and now my goal is to, like, do things that sort of break the rules a little bit, because that's a lot more fun.
So you were talking about advice. What's the worst advice you've ever gotten?
Oh man, I got some bad advice, but
top two or three then.
Yeah. I think the worst advice, and this is a weird one, but in college, this is how broadcast news works. You are supposed to graduate from college and then go to a very, very small station. The smallest station in the country is Glendive, Montana. I don't know how many people it has, but I do know it's the smallest station in the country.
Okay.
Then, if you're lucky, you'll move up within 2 years. And then, if you're lucky again, you'll move up in 5 years, and then you'll be at, like, the job you wanted. And so that's sort of how all of journalism works. So, like, that's how hockey broadcasting is supposed to work, and that's how, you know, being, like, in any sort of entertainment, is you're supposed to follow these steps. And I definitely bought into that idea. And it wasn't true. Like, looking at my classmates and looking at the people that have jobs, where I was like, oh, I would have enjoyed doing that. None of them followed that path. Like, they, you know, got a break early, or they, they went a completely different route and got in the company in the back door, and then they saw how valuable they were. And I think that that was the piece of advice that I feel like I wish I hadn't listened to, was I should have found the places that I wanted to work and just figured out how to put my foot in the door. And I mean, that's sort of what I will probably do now. But that, like, the people matter so much more than the process. On that sort of note and sort of thinking about that, I think the other advice that I got that I don't think was that good was just how important social media presence is. Mm-hmm. In a lot of places, you know, they just push like having social media, and I definitely bought into that and like was social media obsessed. And a lot of places shouldn't have social media because they're not good at it and they don't understand it, and their customers or audience isn't there. And I feel like I spent a lot of time working on building up social media projects that no one was really waiting for and didn't actually help me.
That is really an interesting view on that. Cause yeah, I've heard that nonstop, especially with podcasts now and stuff. Social media. Got to post on social media. Have to have Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, however I find your podcast, like what I would recommend as you're going forward is the people that like your podcast, find out what they like about it and how they came in contact with it, and then really focus on that. Because honestly, like, some people do really great on Instagram and they understand Instagram.
Yeah.
I've never done well on Instagram. I don't understand the audience on Instagram, and I don't think my audiences are there. But Twitter is great for developing your personality, but it's not great for sharing work because no one goes places on Twitter. And so it's just like, it's figuring those rules out. And you know, 5 years ago, it was all like, how do you beat SEO on Google? And then Google changes algorithm. And so all these people that wasted all this time becoming SEO experts, it doesn't matter anymore. Like, they really can't help you that much.
Yeah.
On the other side of that, if those people had spent time building a newsletter, you know, email is one of the few ways that we still have communication with each other. And so that's a better asset than, you know, figuring out how to be better on Google, because you still have those email addresses. However, Google has changed the way that email works now. And so a lot of those emails go to updates or promotion. And, you know, it's no longer the direct connection that you used to have on email. And so worrying too much about how you're using the social media just seems so much less important than just building an audience that likes you.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it, building an audience. And I think that's the tough part is, and something that we're still trying to figure out here is, you know, what's the audience look like? Because I think yeah. We're very broad. This podcast kind of appeals to like a broad audience itself. And then, you know, we try to mix it up with guests and stuff. And it's, you know, a lot of word of mouth driven. So that's mm-hmm. also kind of different. But
and I think like most successful things are word of mouth driven in one way or another, mm-hmm. but that's not, no one's going to teach you that, because I can't sell it. Like if I came to you and I was like, listen, I'm going to get you a lot of audience followers, and I'm going to do it by people are going to talk about your podcast. Mm-hmm. Like you can't measure that. So
no,
I can't like bill you for that time.
Yep.
And I think the other thing is, you know, you can have audiences that are, that you're bringing together more than one audience. You just have to figure out how often do you have to feed each group to make them happy. So, you know, like if your podcast, let's say that, you know, you have a lot of people that really love books and you decided to put a book segment on the podcast, but it's only like once every 3 weeks, like, is that enough to keep the book people around for the episodes where they're like, I don't really like this aspect of the show. Mm-hmm. And that, like, that's something that I sort of just an experimentation thing, and not being so worried about like individuals, more just like sort of like trends and that.
That's good advice. to put it bluntly, that's good advice. I haven't heard that before, actually. That's really different way of looking at it. You know, everybody's talked about social media, everybody's talked about content and, you know, all the buzzwords that you hear nowadays. So
well, and I sort of I don't I didn't come up with this concept, and I don't remember where it was, but it's sort of how I do my own social media or my own podcast listening, especially. Like, you know, there are some shows that I will listen to every week because I love everything about them. But most shows I will only listen to if either the topic is really interesting or the guest is really interesting. And so those people keep me around by every so often. They feed me with the guest that I like. And I'm willing to sit through the content where I'm like, I'm not that interested in it. And it's nothing against you. It's just like, I have no interest in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally get that. So I guess just to kind of bring it all together, what are you curious about right now? Like, what excites you right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is just I'm excited for whatever the next step is, and really feeling like I feel like I've sort of gained some of my confidence back. And like this conversation is also helping me with this, where it's like there are thoughts on how the world works that I really want to share in different ways, and feeling like that's valuable again. I still am not quite sure how to do that. But I do think that I'm getting excited about doing that again, which I just think is so important. And I definitely had lost. One thing that I've been playing around a lot with is looking at how social media affects our lives in really weird ways. And I'll just give you a quick analogy on this, because I've been thinking a lot about this. But, you know, if you think about the standard auditorium where you go and see a play, they all have an arch around them in like a standard theater, not in the round, nothing fancy. And that arch is called the proscenium. And all of our media has developed with this proscenium idea. So the proscenium goes into movie theaters, and then it goes into television. And now the proscenium is our phone, and it's separate. It surrounds our lives. And the thing about a proscenium on the stage is you have the knowledge when you're looking at it that there are things behind the curtain that you cannot see. And things happen off stage that you cannot see. But we have lost the ability as a culture to understand that when you see a post on Instagram, that is a moment in time, and you cannot see what's happening outside of the frame or what's happening between posts. And so that's an idea that I'm really interested in exploring, and sort of different ways to play with that idea that it's so easy for us to make stories from one post to the next from somebody. And it's harder to say, we don't actually know what's going on, but we know something is going on between the scenes.
That's actually something I've always kind of been interested in myself. Wondering what you could call it the background or the behind the scenes is behind every single social media influencer's post. I mean, obviously it isn't what it appears to be.
Yeah. And I have a few friends that are getting divorced, which this is like the first time in my life that they're getting divorced. And it's like, it's very cryptic that they're getting divorced. Like no one posted was like, listen, I'm getting divorced. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, like stuff goes away suddenly and all the pictures are gone. And suddenly they're posting like statuses where they're like, you know, like I've had to fight through all of these things. And you're like, first of all, this probably isn't the avenue that you should be working out your deal. Mm-hmm. Like, this probably isn't going to be healthy for you. But also, it's just like, you can like make up the stories in your head from what you know, but you can only know so much. But you get like that backbone and your mind just kind of goes crazy about like, I wonder which thing about this person was it?
It's an interesting society we live in now. Just even as a kid, and I'm a little bit older than you, I'm 33. And so I remember being a kid and, you know, not having internet even. I didn't have internet probably until I was like 15, 14 years old. So I was actually late to the internet. And there wasn't like I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, it was better in my day. You know, like, I don't believe that. You know, I think life's constantly improving. Things are getting easier, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I remember a time where it just started to get to a point where everybody really needed attention. Everybody really needed to be noticed, and everyone was going to be famous. And there was this promise of not 15 minutes of fame anymore, but it was almost like, you can have your 6 seconds of fame on Vine or, yeah. you know, and I struggle with that because I've got kids myself and, you know, they're a huge part of the social media age. And now I'm having to try to explain to them like, hey, being noticed isn't that important. If you want to be noticed, you'll be noticed, you know, based on who you are, not what you've posted or.
And yeah.
So that's a really interesting concept to me.
Yeah. And it's sort of, I mean, it feeds into this idea that it was like, there was this moment in our society where we were like, everyone's opinion is valuable. And it's like, we realized that that isn't true. Mm-hmm. Like every, you know, I don't care about most people's opinions about most issues. Mm-hmm. And so like the fact that that's sort of how our social media life has developed is so weird and so interesting. But at the same time, like you and I would not be having this conversation without social media.
Well, that's
so
true.
Like, obviously, like it has its positives. And I think especially earlier on in the nexus of, you know, Twitter in particular, like it was a great place for sports.
You know, and I think partially it still kind of is, and it's a great way to connect if it's used properly. But I'm also kind of surprised that, you know, a war hasn't been started over social media or, you know.
Yeah.
Because you can say whatever you want at any time.
This seems like the thing that I, like, and thinking about, like, it before, and I mean, I think there's a lot of great things still about Twitter, but, like, the civility of it, like, people are just outraged all the time, and mm-hmm. it makes you, like, I mean, I've been very happy with the mute button, like, I'm so happy they have that on Twitter, because you can just be, like, you like, throw a tantrum every time the Avalanche lose, and I'm not sure I want to do it anymore, so goodbye.
Yeah.
And, like, I think that's been, like, a good thing, so it's sort of, like, we've got to, like, recreate content walls around ourselves because no one else is going to do it. And so it's like you can create your own experience in a way. And it's like, how do we make those experiences better at this point?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's given everybody, you know, a bullhorn.
Yeah.
So that's also, I don't know if it's a problem, but it's a thing, I guess, you know, everybody's got this bullhorn, their opinion's the most important thing on the planet.
Yeah. I think that's the problem, that people think that it matters.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and I mean, there's credence to that because of some of the high profile people that, you know, mm-hmm. do stuff on social media. But like, at the end of the day, social media is not your life, no matter how much time you spend on it. And so you have to be able to make that distinction. Or else, like, I think you're just going to be miserable.
Oh, yeah. Social media definitely will make you miserable if you're not, you know, if you're not especially earning, you know, if you're not earning millions and millions of dollars from posting about Puma or, you know.
Yes, but I will say the people that I know that are in that line of work are miserable.
Well, then.
Because they, you know, you lose all your freedom when that. The people tell you where to go and what to do, and it takes 12 to 14 hours a day, and it's so interesting. Like, I would be interested to know which people who are purely social media influencers and nothing else, if any of them are happy.
I mean, that's interesting. It brings up the old grass is always greener.
Yeah. So. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's just like, it's so weird to think about, like, just like, this is your life. And it's like, you've built your own cage.
Yeah. I don't think people really realize that. Maybe not until it's too late.
Yeah, no, I think that you can't see the end of it. There's this great, going back to Reply All, anyone that wants to listen, there's this episode about a pet YouTuber, and this is a community of people that just, like, love pets, and so these people get a bunch of pets. And the problem with this is, if you're going to keep getting followers, you have to keep getting pets. Like, that's the game you're in. So you just become, like, a full-time pet person.
Oh, weird.
And, you know, you have weird exotic lizards and probably stuff you were never that interested in, because that's how you build up your brand in pet YouTube.
That's so interesting. I've never heard of this. That's really, I mean, I don't want to be too judgy, but it's odd. It's like really bizarre to, I don't know. I talk with my kid a lot about this because he's kind of at that YouTube age right now. He's 8 years old. And so he's very interested in YouTube and social media. And, We don't allow him on Facebook or Instagram or anything, but he does watch YouTube, and he wants to be a YouTuber when he grows up. And it's so odd to me because it's, you can really do anything with that. Like, do you want to be like, I don't know, Logan Paul is a good example, you know, making fun of suicide, or do you want to be, you know, somebody who's positive? You can really, I mean, it's vast and open.
Yeah, I would highly recommend at some point. I don't know if you know who Bo Burnham is, but he just released this movie called Eighth Grade. I don't know if you saw it.
I haven't yet, but I know of it, actually, and it's on my list.
I would highly recommend that, and his interview he did on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, where he just talked about this phenomenon where he was like doing his comedy shows, and he was like, the thing is that the teenagers know what I'm going through because they feel like they're performing their lives the whole time on these YouTube channels. And it's just so, it's so weird. And I don't think it's bad, but he did say something at the end of the interview that has really stuck with me, where he was like, if you can live a life where you don't have to perform, do it, because that's how you'll be happy.
I 100% believe that. I mean, we've had situations where my son has, you know, he created this world for himself, immersed in, you know, Roblox or whatever, this game that he plays, where he had friends and stuff, and the friends just all of a sudden disappear, or they stop talking to each other, or and you would just throw him into like this depression. And I'd never seen an 8-year old be depressed, you know. And obviously,
yeah, that's awful.
Obviously, it happens, but you know, so we really had to pull him back and start rethinking how we allow him to interact on social media and how we allow him to experience it. Because my gosh, you know, he was thinking this world was real and these kids were real and they're his friends, and we didn't even realize he was doing that. You know, that's another thing about social media and YouTube and stuff like that, is you don't realize that it is this world out there, and you do become part of this community.
Well, and I mean, we know this from people we've seen, but people don't realize that Twitter is real life too sometimes, where they'll say things and they'll lose their job, and you're like, this is like a more serious, like all of this is so serious, and it like feels like it's just like you can hide behind a screen, but like there is really no hiding at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that a very well-known person lost his job a couple years ago because of a Twitter interaction. I mean, that's, it's a very real thing.
Yeah. So it's if you can live a life where you don't perform, do it. But I haven't figured out how to do that yet, so I am still going to keep writing, I guess.
Well, I enjoy it, so I would.
Well, thanks.
I would say keep going. just selfishly.
I would say for you, keep doing the podcast. So we'll keep in this world, but advise everyone else, stop doing it.
Yeah.
Get out.
Well, thank you so much, Derek, for being on. You know, I'd love to do this again sometime.
Yeah, definitely. And thanks so much for having me. And I hope you continue to build it. And I can't wait to see what you build by episode 100.
Well, yeah, thank you. And you know what? Thanks for that that quarter of the way through advice. I appreciate it. And you know what? I'm going to remind myself of that all the time. So thank
you. Glad to hear it. That was some game last night.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was amazing. Actually, the last couple games have been pretty amazing to watch.
They have. Yeah, I was at both of the two home games, and I think the Monday game was a lot more fun, but you know, it's really hard to beat a come from behind overtime win.
Yeah, yeah. Last 5 minutes of the game especially, and then
yeah.
That was
and
incredible.
Then they just dominated in overtime.
Oh yeah, they killed it. Nathan MacKinnon looks possessed. He looks like just unstoppable out there. And then McCarr, he looked a little lost last night, I thought, but you know, nothing unexpected. Still made like some great plays though. His outlet passes are incredible.
Yeah, I mean, he can hit any guy anywhere on the ice, it seems like, which is just, and he's played two games.
He looks like he's been playing for, you know, forever. He looks completely NHL ready, like had no problems. You know, obviously he was a little chemistry wise, like he's still figuring things out, but it looks like you can just kind of like insert him on any team and he'd be fine.
Yeah, and I mean, they played him with basically every defenseman, I think, except for Zadorov at some point last night, and he like never looked that lost. So I'm with you that it's not, he wasn't quite as sharp, but also like
yeah.
Calgary played a lot better too. So
that's true, yeah. And they definitely seemed to cover him a little bit better. Didn't leave him as wide open as they did his first game.
I don't know. I'm optimistic that maybe they could actually win the series, which hasn't happened in so long.
I actually saw a rumor, maybe it was from Adrian Dater, saying that the Avs are going to make a push for Panarin this summer.
Yeah, apparently they are. And I mean, I think from what I've heard, they and Florida are going to be the two that have the best chance there. But if they could get him, I don't know if you saw, and I still don't really understand Corsi, but his Corsi was 100 points higher than anybody else on Columbus. Like, he's that much better than everyone else on that team.
That's crazy because he's such a like big scorer. It's insane to see a score. Like, I don't really understand Corsi that well at all. As far as I know, you know, it's possession versus scoring versus like giveaways versus like all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
It's really confusing, but you don't see too many goal scorers with high Corsi like that.
Yeah. And they're just, I mean, if they can add a fourth guy to play with, you know, and they can split up, like move Landeskog down with another guy that can really score. I mean, they're getting back to the, you know, the glory days as far as the offense.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah,
Jost and Compher have both looked great in this series. I know Jost hasn't scored, but he's looked so much better.
Oh yeah, he's been all over the place too. I thought he had a couple of miscues last night, but he recovered so well. It really didn't even matter. He's gotten a lot smarter with the puck over the last, I don't know, couple months especially.
Yeah, I think so. After he came back up from the minors.
One guy that I really like actually is Andrew Ghetto. I think he brings a lot of like good energy. You know, he's not a scorer, he's not exciting, but he brings a lot of energy, I think, to the team. He reminds me of Cody McLeod, actually.
Yeah, they're not quite the same players, but they definitely have that energy. That, like, you know, they like to put him in the box for the so he can try to race up the ice if he gets off if they beat the penalty kill. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him.
Yeah, I enjoy watching him. I don't know. It just seems like every time they scratch him, the Avs are just a little bit flat-footed and a little bit, you know, just not as physical of a team. I think he brings like a lot of physical presence.
I think they've been a lot better since he's been in and Brassard's been out. I liked Brassard at the beginning, but he's just killing them the last couple of weeks, I feel like.
I was excited to trade for Brassard. But yeah, he hasn't really been like a game changer at all. And he really hasn't been a factor in most games, period. So it's kind of disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. So I don't, like, it'll be interesting to see. Like, I don't know if he's healthy. Like, they sort of said he was healthy for the last game and then they didn't play him. But I'm guessing Bednar just didn't want to screw up with the lineup. And it'll be interesting to see when Girard's healthy. I think they're going to go with seven defensemen, at least at the beginning, because he's playing that fourth line so little. So that will be interesting too.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I saw an article like this morning or last night, maybe. I think it was this morning, that said they were thinking of sitting Girard the next game too, just to not screw with the lineup like you were saying. And that's interesting to me because Girard is like a huge part of that defense. So I would think, they'd probably have to go with seven.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Nimmis would probably only play on the penalty kill. Like, he would probably play a little bit more and they'd shuffle him in, but that'd probably be where he got most of his minutes.
Yeah.
So, it'll be interesting.
It should.
Better problems than they normally have.
Oh, yeah. Their defense looks 100 times better than even last year, and I thought they improved quite a bit last year.
Yeah.
But they look amazing right now, and they peaked at the right time finally.
I know. And they were so bad that it's just like, yeah, if you're just going to say on like the middle of February,
yep,
that not only were they going to make the playoffs, but they were going to have a 3 games to try to clinch the second round. I would not have believed that.
No, and I think Landeskog's leadership over the last few years, I mean, I think he's really grown. At first, you know, I was a little bit skeptical of such a young kid being a captain, but then you look at guys like Crosby and Taves, and obviously they turn out just fine. And
yeah.
So.
Well, and you know, they did that because they were basically just mad at O'Reilly. That was that first contract negotiation where he held out, and they're like, fine, we'll just give the captain to Landeskog.
I mean, I get that though.
It was a bad situation, but that's not like, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence if you're like, well, we just like picked the guy and he may be our youngest player, but we're still going to pick him.
Yeah. Well, he was a captain for the Kitchener Rangers for a long time. So I thought at least he's got that, you know, leadership quality, but he just didn't look ready that first year. But like, this is his team for sure now. Like, you can really tell.
Yeah, I mean, that hug that he gave McCarr, and he's much better with the refs. Like, he looks a lot more like, you know, he's in control when he goes and talks to them, which is quite a lot in this series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the misconducts, the last, not the last game, but the previous game, that was crazy at the end there. That's why I love playoff hockey, though. Like, I love two teams who all of a sudden hate each other in the playoffs. I think that's great.
Yeah, I know. And I'm just like, it just gets better as it goes on. And it's just been so long that I'm just like, you can make the second round. And really right now, like, there isn't a team where I'm like, well, the Avs have no chance against them. If they play like this, they have a chance. And so it's just like, it's just nice to have that as a possibility, no matter how far of a long shot everything is right now.
Yeah, they've pretty much got a chance against anybody. I'm trying to think, you know, Vegas would be tough, but I think they probably can overcome that. I mean, especially with the goal scorers we have right now. Dallas is kind of peaking at a good time, and Bishop's always been a tough opponent for us. Let's see. Yeah, I mean.
And the Blues that I don't really know what happened to them. So they're also the one I'm afraid of in the West.
Yeah, I guess the Blues would probably be their biggest challenge or obstacle. Yeah, the Blues are on fire, but Binnington's young and you never know. And I don't know, we'll see what happens. I mean, they're gonna make it to the second round most likely, and so
yeah, if they don't, we're gonna be so sad.
If
they get to a game 7, I'm gonna be so sad. Like, they really need to win one of the next two.
I'm just gonna knock on wood right now, just in case I didn't jinx the Avs. I don't want to jinx the Avs or anything. I love that team and love to see them go the second round. That'd be awful. Maybe we should just not. We'll cut all this out. Not post it. Just Sonata.
Yeah, just you can do like bonus content. Yeah, when the Avs make it to the second round. Be like,
yeah,
this there is what we thought, but we don't want to say anything.
Yeah, maybe I'll hold out and post this episode after they make it in. That way, it's like really relevant, and we didn't jinx them at all.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll think about that.